Okay, so today we have with us Yeshi, founder of Data for Black Lives. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Super excited to have you here with us on the show today. I have mentioned to you that my community members were just so ecstatic to have you join us for our Equity in Tech Summit during Wisconsin Tech Month last year. And I'm just super grateful that we're able to continue the conversation and introduce you to some of our wider audience. I always like to start with a little a lighthearted question. So brace yourself. What music are you listening to these days?
I love music, so that's a great question. Actually, what I've been listening to is the music of some of the artists that are involved with our Decompress program. That's one of our newest programs at Data for Black Lives, where we are reclaiming electronic music as a Black technology, the history, the past, but also looking at the current ways in which people are electronic music, whether it's techno house, but also hip hop, roots reggae, dub, how it really helped shape culture and like kind of change the world, actually. So we have a couple of artists who we were able to highlight and book to perform, to speak. And I'm listening to some of their mixes and also a track that one of the artists just recorded in our studio. So which I'm excited. So that's literally what I've been listening to a lot. The music that folks from our community and our network have been making, especially under this mandate of like, let's reclaim electronic music as a tool for social change, and as a technology that has been pioneered by Black folks and also that is like now just spread to the whole world. So yeah, one of the artists is my friend John Arrow. The song hasn't been released, but he did a cover of Sade's song Pearls, which was so beautiful, and I've just been honestly listening to that nonstop. So yeah.
That's really exciting. So it sounds like your this program is introducing you to some new artists, and maybe it could even serve as a platform to introduce the artist to a wider audience too.
Exactly. Yes.
I love that. I love that. Well, I have a basic answer. I've just been listening to Cowboy Carter.
Oh, yeah, I've been listening to that too. I've been listening to that too.
I love country music, and so when
Yeah.
Beyonce entered the chat, I was like, "Oh,
Me
let me tune
too.
in."
And what she did with that was not only create an amazing album, but really introduce us to so many other Black country artists that I didn't even know about. I'm so thankful to her for that, honestly. Like, it's she's just iconic.
And so to dive in now to your work, okay, you are founder and CEO of Data for Black Lives. Share more about your journey in creating this organization and some of the work that you're most excited about.
Sure. Data for Black Lives, we were officially incorporated in December. I know the date because it's on our IRS letter, December 23rd, 2017. But so much of the work around Data for Black Lives comes from my upbringing. It really comes out of my experiences of really straddling these two worlds of activism, organizing, and really activism and organizing because I saw the problems in my community. I was directly impacted and was like desperate and really searching for a way to address them. And data became the way. And as well as my, like, since childhood, I was online. I'd learned to code in middle school. And it was just a way for me to bring all these worlds together. And I talked about it in the keynote that I gave at your wonderful event, but my first time even collecting data was after some young people who went to a neighboring high school, te technically my home school, had organized a peaceful protest in response to a vice principal putting another student in a chokehold. This was like 2007, 2008, before we had like really high crisp cell phone video. But I remember being at home and seeing on TV, on national news, CNN, students riot at Miami Edison Senior High. I knew that it was not a riot. I knew that the images of literally them being pushed against police cars, kids being arrested, was such an oversized and extreme and aggressive response to literally young people from a predominantly low income, predominantly Black and immigrant school, just trying to stand up for themselves and say, hey, like, we want our school to be a place for learning, not like this kind of weird crime fighting. We're not criminals, we're kids, we're students.
Right.
And for me, it made me realize, yes, protest and nonviolent protest is very important. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, we were going also to, you know, after this happened, to the school board meetings at the reserved public comment section that we had, where we had our prepared speeches and we're talking about what's happening in our schools and making demands for things like restorative justice, only to be kicked out of those meetings and kind of shunned. So data really became the way to speak for people who, for us, for young people, for young Black people from communities that were already marginalized, already, you know, mm-hmm. just off the radar totally, and became the sum of our voices and our experiences. And we hit the ground running and we collected over 600 surveys. And I just remember the feeling of like literally being, you know, outside of different schools and on the bus surveying young people about their experiences with suspensions, arrest, and what their dreams and visions were for their schools, and realizing, wow, like, not only are we collecting so much important information that is going to be really helpful to us making the case. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, like, it sucks that we had to be the ones to have the burden of proof. Like, we shouldn't have even had to do this, but in that process of data collection, I realized this was the first time some of these young people had even been asked their opinion. And that's when I realized, wow, like, this is so powerful. And that was really what built my commitment. It took us time to actually get restorative practices put into the school. It wasn't until I graduated from college and then came back, and then we were able to actually get a significant win on that campaign. But it really changed my life. And when I graduated, I ended up going to Brown University, which was such a blessing. And it was the perfect school for me because I had the opportunity to, Brown has an open curriculum where you could really like take whatever you want, honestly. Sometimes that's a bad thing. But for me, being this young person where I'm like, look, my community needs people who have the experience I have, who look like me, and who are able to do qualitative methods. Mm-hmm. I literally was taking PhD level statistics classes.
Wow.
Like, all of this because I had an opportunity every summer, every break, to go bring all these skills right back to Miami. And that's what I did. And like, yes, I learned a lot on this Ivy League campus, but my real education was when I brought it home and applied it. And I had an opportunity to apply it because I was already involved in some of this work that was happening. So when I graduated, you know, the organization that I was a part of, Power U, which was a Black-led small community organization, you know, they had launched a campaign around Black infant mortality. And actually, I think today is like the last day of Black Infant Mortality Week, Black Maternal Health Week, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even at that time, that this was 2013, I'm aging myself, this is 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
But we were seeing in the community that, you know, like when we were looking at the data around Black babies were three times as likely to die before their first birthday than white babies, we saw why, at least in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
We saw what was happening in terms of hospital policies, overuse of cesarean section, and just other abuses that now are well documented, way more you know, talked about, thankfully, honestly, because of a lot of Black women celebrities who have come up and talked about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even then, I saw, wow, like a white mother who had a high school education had better birth outcomes than a Black woman with 15 years of education. So what is going
Isn't that
on?
something? And the data helps to sort of drive awareness, but more importantly, to spark action, right? To find solutions for these issues, but not unless there are people who are willing to do the work, to work with the communities, to understand what the data is saying. What your story resonates so much with me. I'm a data girly myself. So I love leveraging data. I did a TEDx talk called Data Tells a Story, because I understand how important it is to our communities to not just collect data, but have data be owned and mined by our communities. That part, right? And also, I didn't realize that Data for Black Lives was founded in 2017. So it was Milky Way Tech Hub. Okay, so
oh, look at that. That's incredible.
great minds think alike, right? We were ready to get out there and make some impact at the same time. That's incredible. But you're doing such incredible work, making significant impact. And one of the campaigns that you mentioned at our Equity and Tech Summit, I'd love for you to share more, is your Algorithm is Apartheid campaign. Can you share more about that? What does that mean to you? And
so that was actually a special talk that I did just for Milwaukee.
Okay.
And just for the political moment that we're in, there's so much happening right now regarding the war in Israel and Gaza. Mm-hmm. And there's more people talking about apartheid. And I think for us at Data for Black Lives, what we want people to understand is how apartheid is not isolated to one place. It's an algorithm. Places like Palestine have become laboratories for policies, just like Haiti, just like Sudan. And so much of what even Nazi Germany and South Africa had, who's really pioneered some of these like policies around social exclusion and segregation, so much of that comes from the US case, actually. And the way it connects to our work is it connects to our Abolish Big Data campaign, because when we recognize that apartheid, which is the system by which people are separated by racial groups and other phenotypical characteristics or origin, and it's a situation of separate but very unequal. Mm-hmm. These policies, that material condition right now is being facilitated by technology in a really, really kind of subtle but very powerful way. Whether it's the ways in which the redlining of the past has become the credit scoring models and mortgage underwriting algorithms of the present, or the ways in which, you know, the Black codes and those policies that were a response to, you know, enslaved African people during Reconstruction, formerly enslaved African people during Reconstruction, really like gaining political power and prominence, you know, have kind of become the, you know, facial recognition, social media surveillance, and other technological sort of like strategies today to really use to like intimidate, surveil, control, and a lot of times like really neutralize communities' ability to act and speak and think for themselves. And for us, to abolish big data really means to abolish the structures that put the power of data into the hands of a few, and to put it in the hands of those who need it the most, right? Yeah. In this case, you know, a lot of times some of these people who we interact with at big tech companies, even in government agencies that's responsible for a lot of the harm, they don't even, it's not like they're maliciously trying to do this. They're not, they don't represent, nor do they really know anybody from directly impacted communities like Black communities. Mm-hmm. And they don't oftentimes fully understand the context by which the technologies that they're working in are operating. So for us, it's really important that we ensure that, just as we're talking about now with whether it's Black moms in Miami and ensuring that, you know, they're the ones leading the data collection and they're the ones pushing forward the policy and they're the ones shaming the hospitals, which actually got the policy passed. Mm-hmm. Or it's in our case, you know, launching our Movement Scientist Fellowship, where while we're in the White House and advocating and dealing with big tech companies and pushing back, we're also equipping people with the skills, the vision, and most importantly, the empathy and the understanding and the ethics to be able to create and build responsible technologies.
You know, one thing that really struck me in your talk was how you highlighted the data, the abundance of data that was being leveraged by slave owners, and how intricate and detailed those that data set was, even for, you know, in that time period, and how like the systems that were built in that time period carry over now, even into how data is mined today, and the culture and the structure of big data today. So I thought that that was interesting. Now with the ever and quickly evolving artificial intelligence space, I mean, I speak with community members all the time, and some of them are saying, you know, how afraid they are about how AI is taking jobs and things like that. But I think that another layer or added perspective is that I think that this time of evolving artificial intelligence, I think that we're going to see more an increase of historians and philosophers and people who initially would have not seen themselves in the field of technology are going to be needed in order for us to better regulate and to tell more accurate stories and advocate for communities of color in the field of technology. Because without philosophers, without historians, without people who have a really good sense of what's happened in the past, it's going to be difficult for us to regulate and advocate in this space. So I was super grateful that you went that deep into your talk, because I think a lot of people don't make that connection. Big data has been around for a while, and we have to understand how to break down those systemic barriers in this space.
Yes.
So I'd love to, for you to talk maybe just a little bit more about some of your priorities for Data for Black Lives in 2024. What are the policies that you guys are maybe looking to advocate for? And what are some of the main focus areas?
Sure, yeah. For us, our main campaigns right now is abolish big data, like I said, and that translates into federal and local policy. On the federal level, we were really involved in the White House executive order, and continue to be involved in ensuring that, you know, everything that comes out from the top and the bottom actually has teeth right now. That we are, as the world, and especially as the US, is deciding policies that'll affect the development of AI for the next 50 to even 100 years, that we are bringing in the right concerns and actually uplifting the voices of people who jobs could be taken and whose lives are already being shaped by artificial intelligence and automated decision-making systems. I'm continuing to push for example, that looks like the use case that we've been really elevating is looking at FICO credit scores, right? Like FICO scores are the most predominant and ubiquitous algorithm in the US. They're responsible for 90% of lending decisions. A lot of people think that FICO is a government agency, even people who work in the government. It's not. It's a private company with shareholders, founded in Silicon Valley, based in Bozeman, Montana. And that's fine, but they should not have so much power over one company, should not have so much power over people's lives. And and the data just shows how, you know, even when you control for income and debt, Black people are scored the language is important are scored much lower than their white counterparts, than their Asian counterparts. And you see a little bit more closer parity with Latinx counterparts and like at the bottom. And, you know, you need a 650 credit score to even qualify for an FHA loan. You cannot rent an apartment in most metropolitan cities without a 700. So while the government and people in different agencies are and academics are thinking about how do we develop guidelines around AI model understanding, contestability, transparency, interoperability, all these big words, our thing is, no, we need to start with an algorithm that's already being used that is affecting everybody and some very negatively. Some people are benefiting from having a high credit score already in a system that's kind of rigged. So that's one major area. I'll mention another one for the sake of time, not everything that we're working on, but our No More Data Weapons campaign. This is a really localized campaign that we're right now focusing on DC. We are at the end of a 2-year litigation where we have been literally having to sue Metropolitan Police Department and the city of DC just to get more information about social media monitoring. And based on the data that we've gotten, documents, emails, training documents, tweets, geolocation data, it just shows the ways in which specifically Black communities, specifically people you know, who were involved in the George Floyd protest and not January 6th for some reason, well, we know why, mm-hmm. were like disproportionately targeted. And how, you know, one thing I learned from the people who I know who are police, they always tell me police like to work. Police like to work smart, not hard, right? Meaning they like to do the least amount of work as possible. Mm-hmm. And it was important for me to learn that because we kind of see that with social media. Mm-hmm. The police should not be online making fake accounts, trying to find people who are, you know, going to, like, it's insane. And like, it's not only is it like not safe, it's not community safety, it's not public safety, but it's actually direct targeting and surveillance. It's also just like, this is not addressing crime. This is not addressing carjacking. And this is not providing the community the support that they need to actually address some of the root causes. And for us, we're, you know, yes, you know, we're going to be releasing a report that's showing the extent of social media monitoring as a practice and equipping this information, equipping local collectives and organizations in DC with this information so that they can be able to push back and be at the table as Mayor Bowser is now putting out this omnibus crime bill. And there's lots of conversations around what the future of DC is going to be, right? Like, you know, we support community safety, we support mental health, we support all that, but like, social media monitoring, the use of facial recognition, the use of these technologies that are not proven, and the violation of people's First Amendment rights is just not the way to go. So that's a really big focus. And we hope that with this campaign, we can really create a use case and a toolkit to help people in other communities get these, you know, like, actually help, you know, address some of the uses of data weapons, as we name it, in response to crime, which this is not, again, it's really just targeting the communities who have already been targeted. Mm-hmm. I think finally, I'm really excited that we will be bringing back our Data for Black Lives conference.
Yes.
This is our flagship event, and it really is the heart of what we do. Yes, policy change is important. Yes, research is important. Suing the city of DC, that's great. But for us, and really for me as a founder, like, the most important thing is community organizing. It's creating a space of belonging, connection, love, care,
yes,
where people can come in and have critical conversations. It's sometimes the stuff we talk about on our panels, climate gentrification, the impact of, you know, militarization, like these things are big topics, but in an environment that's also, let's focus on solutions and let's put people on stage who are really doing the work so that we can really uplift what's working and do that and continue to do that systems change. And it's just a fun and beautiful and wonderful environment. And I really see this third conference as being like a family reunion and a way for us to really, you know, post-election and beyond. It's happening in late November. We're going to be announcing all the details, but I don't want to like announce too much.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to do my best to be there. If yes. there's like even opportunities to apply to speak, I'm going to do it because
we already had that initial conversation. So that's good to hear.
I just love the work of Data for Black Lives and everything that you shared. It's so important. And in this space where I feel like D&I is under attack, convening Definitely. Organizers, convening individuals who are actually doing the work is going to be even more important. So I'm grateful to hear that Data for Black Lives flagship event will be back this year. So I'm excited to hear that. We are at time, but I just want to say thank you for joining the MKE Tech podcast and continue to do the good work.
Thank you so much, Adia. I'm so glad that we're connected. And yes, I look forward to talking more about the conference and how you all can be involved. And thank you for this interview. It's awesome.
Thank you. Okay, that's it. I'm going to shoot this over to our podcast producer, and within the next 2 weeks, we'll push it out. Is there any special hashtags or handles that you want us to use when we push it out?
Maybe just data for black, like hashtag data for black lives.
Yeah. Okay.
Sounds good. Send it over and we'll also push it out too.
Okay. That'll be wonderful. Thank you again so much for your time. I'm looking forward to learning more about how we can be involved with the conference. Okay.
Yes. We'll look out for an email about that. So okay. You Sounds have a good day.
Take care. Bye-bye.